Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure that you register for the Here We Still Stand regional event in Bentonville, Arkansas, April 22nd and 23rd. You want to come hang out with Chad Bird and me and a whole bunch of other people. You can get the whole roster of people over at the over on the website. It's going to be a good time. It's only $99 to hang out with us for 2 days. Tons of music, speaking, food, fellowship. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'd love to see you there. So wherever you're at, make sure on April 22nd, you are in Bentonville, Arkansas, hanging out with us. Those conferences are always a blast. Chad, I don't know how many people that listen to this show know, but you have just returned from this land that we're going to be talking about, this land of Israel. That's where you've been for a while. We had to record some episodes in advance because you were going to be out in the Holy Land. And so this is the first time that we've recorded in a little bit.
Yeah, that's why my face is glowing. People can't see that, of course.
Dude, it looks like Moses podcast, coming down from the mountain.
I've got a veil on right now because it's just too bright for Dan to look at our Zoom meeting. Yeah, it was great. We were there for, we were gone for about a week and a half and then in country for about 7 days. Fantastic. Had a great time. In fact, I was just looking here at verse 7 that we finished up with last time, and it mentioned Solomon building these abominations on the mountain east of Jerusalem. And I was saying to myself, I sat in that mountain just a few days ago. I've been on that Mount of Olives where Solomon established all his abominations. So my wife Stacy and I have both realized this. We were in church on Sunday and pastor was teaching Bible class about the transfiguration, and he was mentioning, you know, this and that. And every time a geographical name would come up, we'd look at each other with like this knowing expression, like, oh yeah. We remember sitting in that.
There you go. Chad coming back to the podcast with secret knowledge.
Yeah. Got the gnosis going on here.
Yeah, that's right.
No, it really is. It's like one of those, not just, of course, the Holy Land, but once you've been to a place, you know, when you hear it, you're like, oh, your mind like immediately rushes back. Then you're like, oh, yeah, I remember. I was at the Grand Canyon. It was really cool. This great vista. And it's like that with other stuff, too. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll be like that reading through the scriptures, too. Every time one of these names comes up, you'll be like, oh, yeah, I remember I was standing there and looking at it. And so that in and of itself is a pretty cool different perspective, new perspective to have.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. I've always thought this. Anytime I think things get built up in your mind, I've lived in a bunch of different cities. And I remember when I moved to Seattle. And I remember I drove 32 hours when we moved there, and we had all our stuff and we're driving there. And I remember when I came up on the city, it was cool because you were finally there, but it was like, man, this is much smaller than it was in my mind. And I know Israel's that way, but I think kind of most things are that way. The Grand Canyon might not be that way, but a lot of things, unless you've been there, they don't seem necessarily real. And then once you get there, you're like, oh, these are it's a real place with real streets and real buildings. And in that way, it's not fictional anymore. So you can't embellish it anymore because you have now experienced the thing for what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. And very applicable to Israel too. I was mentioning before we started recording that the Kidron Valley is like that, you know, the Kidron quote unquote valley is, it's like a big ditch, you know, between the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives. So it's not like, if you're living in the Rocky Mountains and you're thinking of valleys, some vast expanse of space between the two mountains. No, it's just like you go down, you go up. It's a pretty, pretty small area. So yeah, all that helped to put things into perspective. But a beautiful country, a lot of diversity in the landscapes there, as most people probably know from just reading the Bible. So it was a great, great trip. Great to be home though.
Yeah. Good to have you back. Well, we left off in 1 Kings chapter 11. We've been, you know, for a couple of weeks, along with the Queen of Sheba, we've been just so impressed with the work that Solomon's doing, how much peace he has, and therefore this has afforded him to just build all kinds of things and bring in exotic animals, and the buildings are incredible, the gold is everywhere, silver doesn't matter at all, and then we find out he, you know, takes 700 wives and 300 concubines, but they got some gods that they're going to bring with them, and you know, under maybe he gets a little pressure, and doesn't think it's a big deal if he lets some of his foreign wives worship some of their foreign gods. What's the harm in that? And that's kind of where we left it. And it turns out a lot of harm in that. And that's what we're going to get into today.
Yeah, it turns out that Yahweh is not too happy about just being the king of Solomon's pantheon.
No.
he's not cool with that. So verse 9 actually begins that way. It says, the Lord was angry with Solomon. Angry why? He says, because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing, what thing? That he should not go after other gods, but he did not keep what the Lord commanded. I mean, that pretty much sums up everything right there.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit beforehand, and I won't go on and on about it, but I do think it's interesting that right before this, we did get these insane numbers that Solomon had 700 wives, 300 concubines, and you might think that God, we're not saying that's a good idea or that God's given that the thumbs up. However, as this is just to make this point because we've made this point over and over again because the scriptures made this point over and over again. That wasn't the thing. Those numbers seem crazy to us. And you would think that maybe you'd have like a line in here where God was really, really upset about him multiplying wives in that way. Like, that's a lot of wives. That wasn't the thing, though. The thing was what that came along with, which was bringing in other gods that then Solomon ends up at least be giving permission for his wives to worship. Maybe he's got to attend some of these worship things with them. And this sort of Solomon's heart had turned away. I don't even know if that means that Solomon is now like a believer in loads and loads of gods and no longer believes in Yahweh. I don't know that that's what it's saying. As much as it's saying is that he's become lazy in the worship life of Israel. He has put the worship life of Israel in extreme jeopardy. And so he has not feared, loved, trusted God above all things and has actually jeopardized other people's worship. He's allowed foreign gods to come in on, you know, with all these wives. And this is the thing that God cannot tolerate.
Yeah, I mean, the minimum we can say is he's aiding and abetting idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, where exactly his heart was, it's, you know, it's difficult to say. I mean, did he actually believe in a pantheon of gods, or was he just permitting that? It is hard to say, but it really, in the end, it doesn't matter, because what he did was basically in practice to establish idolatry in the city. And of course, the great irony here is that Solomon is the son of David, and he's the one who builds this grand temple for Yahweh. Mm-hmm. So you think, man, this guy, he's got his act together. I mean, he knows the way to go. His heart is completely set on monotheism, on Yahweh alone, because he's done these grandiose things for the Lord. Well, then you turn right around, of course, and he's the temple builder is also the idolatrous shrine builder. All over, not even just in, you know, the far reaches of his kingdom, but smack dab in the heart of Israel. In fact, that one I mentioned, where he built something for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. Well, keep in mind that the temple faces east. So, like, if you're looking straight at the altar and then the entrance to the temple, your back is to the east, and you're looking in the temple. That's because the temple opens up to and faces east, so it faces toward the Mount of Olives, and that means that the face of the Lord is facing east, which means that God is, as it were, looking straight across the valley at the Mount of Olives, where you have these idols set up. I mean, it's just that it is literally in God's face where he sets these up. So that explains why God is, as verse 9 says, angry with Solomon, because, as we mentioned multiple times, other gods might be fine with you sleeping around spiritually, but not Yahweh. He wants you and all of you. And just to clarify, not because he is some sort of, you know, crazy, jealous husband who's kind of a, you know, a control freak or something. The reason God is jealous is because he realizes that he wants all of us, and he wants us to want all of him, because that's what's best for us.
Well, yeah, he
in,
wanted
any other way is a path of destruction.
Well, he's the only God, and so you've abandoned him for things that aren't God,
and don't exist. Yep.
Yeah, and things that are while not God are extremely dangerous, and that can lead to destruction. And I mean, we talked a little bit about some of the worship practices of other gods, but things that are horrible are going to end up being horrible for the people of Israel. I mean, it'd be like if your wife like was going to leave you and go to this guy that you knew for sure was going to beat her up every day, and you might say, well, that's not really exactly a husband. It's not good for you. And back, why are you getting so jealous about this, man? Like, why are you so concerned about your wife running around with that guy? You mean that guy that gives her black eyes all the time and like, you know, got her hooked on meth? Or that's the kind of thing it is. Like, these aren't good things to worship. And so God is certainly looking out for the people of Israel whom he loves. I also think that I didn't notice this until we've kind of been going through this, but Solomon does, God speaks to Solomon in a way that he did not speak to David and Saul. Mm-hmm. Where like you sort of have like, what it appears like is sort of direct speech to Solomon, which sort of makes some of this even more surprising. I mean, so, you know, David had, you know, David and certainly Saul, you know, had Samuel, and then, you know, David had Nathan and stuff, but here with Solomon, you get sort of these direct interactions where God's asking, you know, hey, I'll give you anything you want. And Solomon asks for wisdom. And then other times where God tells him, hey, I like this thing that you did. That's great. And then this time God coming to him and tell him, and he's angry. And I guess maybe this is through a prophet, but we don't have it said that that's the case. Where we do have it said that that's the case with earlier kings, like with David and Saul. Which sort of makes it even more surprising. You're like, man, this guy seems to be in like sort of direct communication with God. Why was it so easy for him to make these mistakes? And I think what it shows you is that, you know, people are like, well, if God would just talk to me, then I would know, and then everything would be better. That's not the evidence we have at all in Scripture.
No, we have multiple examples in the Scriptures where if God appears to you and speaks to you, that is absolutely no guarantee of your continued fidelity.
No.
I mean, you could go all the way back. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up. It's kind of a throwback to the Pentateuch days, right? Mm-hmm. Where God was always appearing to people. He appeared to Abraham. He appeared to Jacob. He appeared to Isaac. He appeared to Joseph in his dreams. And so, I mean, God hanging out with people was not that weird if you're reading Genesis. Now, it begins to disappear the farther you go along in the Scriptures. And then, yeah, you can hear Solomon. It's like, wow, this is happening again.
Yeah,
God is speaking directly to him. But as with those earlier guys, so with Solomon too. Yeah, I mean, if God appeared to me right now here in my study and told me to do something or not to do something or gave me a promise or whatever, well, that would be a remarkable epiphany, theophany. But it would in no way guarantee that I would carry that out or I wouldn't screw up along the way. So, yeah, people put way too much stock in visions like that.
And experiencing God directly.
Yeah, like that's the key to obedience right there. No, if you read the Bible, you realize that is utterly false.
Yep.
Utterly false. Read the book of Exodus. Look what happened to the Israelites. God was always appearing to them. And yet, you know, you can't get much more fantastic than God appearing on Mount Sinai to all the Israelites.
Yeah.
And the very first thing they do is build a golden calf.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, back to God's anger and what Solomon does and how God responds to it. So verse 11, therefore the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I've commanded you, here's what I'm going to do. I will surely tear the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. We'll find out who that is in just a minute. Yet for the sake of David, your father, yet for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. So here we have basically God laying out what's going to happen. It's not going to happen directly to Solomon. It's going to happen to his son. We actually see things like that happening in the rest of the Scriptures as well, where it's the son who ends up, you know, either really going down the wrong path or being the one who's in some way bearing the sins of his father or his grandfather. So in this case, what's going to happen is God's going to tear the kingdom away from Solomon and give it to his servant. This, if this sounds familiar to you, that's because this is exactly the kind of language that we have encountered back in 1 Samuel. So 1 Samuel 15, this is when Saul, the first king, is still around, and his prophet is Samuel. And if you remember the whole story, Saul has not obeyed completely what God had said to do. And so through Samuel, here's what we hear. This is 1 Samuel 15, 26, or 15, 20, 28. Samuel says to Saul, oh no, excuse me, let me back up. Verse 27, Samuel turns away from Saul, and Saul reaches out and grabs his robe, and it tears. And Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. Of course, we know that neighbor ends up being David. So the same thing, same Hebrew verb is used here, and it's basically the same thing. So God is going to tear away the kingdom from Solomon, at least most of it, and is going to give it to his servant. And we'll find out later in the chapter that servant's name is Jeroboam. But I love this language in verse 12 and 13. Three times we hear, for the sake of, for the sake of, for the sake of. So for the sake of David, your father, for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen, God is not going to completely tear away all 12 tribes from Solomon, meaning that grace prevails in the end. Solomon screws up in a major way. He's going to suffer the consequences, especially his son, and the rest of his sons are going to suffer the consequences, yet for the sake of David, for the sake of Jerusalem, because of what God has sworn to David, and because he's chosen Jerusalem on account of God's fidelity, he is going to make sure that there remains this lamp in Jerusalem, this ongoing dynasty of David, because it's the dynasty of David that's going to perpetuate the promise of the Messianic seed, the son of David, who is to come.
Isn't it wild how David, while being a notorious sinner, that David's fidelity, or we would say faith, I guess, in Yahweh alone, colors the way that God speaks of him for all time going forward. That it doesn't bring up a lot of, like, there's lots of things you could bring up. They don't come up. Like, what ends up mattering when God speaks of David, what he's speaking about is someone who was not faithful in the way that he necessarily did everything. But the thing you can say about David is he did not go worship other gods. That was not something that he did. Therefore, God can speak of David as somebody who can speak of him as someone who is righteous because he was a man of faith, even though he was most certainly a sinner. I just think it's interesting as we've gone through the life of David that's how it comes up. So, like, for the sake of David is obviously for the sake of the promises I made to David and stuff, but also is that, hey, your father was faithful in his worship of me. So I made him a promise, and therefore I'm going to not do this thing. This punishment is not going to be what it could be. There's no way to, like, get through Judges and, you know, 1st, 2nd Samuel and 1st, 2nd Kings and not realize that the first commandment is the whole deal. There's just no way to do it, man. It's like, it's the whole thing to God.
Yeah, yeah. It is everything. Everything flows from it. All the commandments are but extensions and applications of the first commandment.
Yeah.
They all lead back to that. Like, that's the source of the other nine streams, if you will, that flow from it. Everything goes back to that. Because the first commandment is all about fearing, loving, trusting God above all things, basically being all God's and God all yours. And if that's the case, then you're exactly where God wants you to be. You're at complete fellowship with him. And if you have that, you've got it all.
Yeah.
So I was looking up, by the way, this phrase, for the sake of, and it occurs not just here, but several other times. We're going to see it in 2 Kings, where we read 2 Kings 8:19, the Lord was not willing to destroy Judah for the sake of David, his servant. 2 Kings 19, God says he's going to defend the city for the sake of my servant, David. 2 Kings 20, God is once more going to defend this city. He says, for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. And then Isaiah 37 repeats that as well. So over and over and over, we hear that kind of language. And when I hear it, with one ear, yeah, I hear for the sake of David, my servant. With my other ear, I hear for the sake of Christ,
yeah,
the son of David.
Absolutely.
I mean, that really is, to put it in New Testament language, you know, why are we not destroyed? Why are we okay with God? Why are we at peace with him? For the sake of the son of David.
Yeah.
It all goes back to him.
When you're reading this kind of stuff too, as God's like goes to Solomon and is telling him, hey, I'm about to do some things that you're really not like because of this idolatry. I like hear back to Hebrews where it says like, without faith, it is impossible to please God.
Mm-hmm.
And every time, so every time that God is displeased, it's because, and this is all we're talking about here, is that you're starting to believe in other gods, right? Worshiping other gods is to believe in other gods. To worship Yahweh alone is to believe in Yahweh alone. This is all a matter of faith, not faithfulness in every way, but faith in God. And you do see that exemplified, that God is pleased with David because David believes in God, and God is displeased in Solomon because he doesn't believe in him alone. And like, faith is sort of the whole thing.
It is. Yeah, that's what this all boils down to, basically, which is because that's what the first commandment is really all about.
Mm-hmm.
When God says you shall have no other gods, he's basically saying, hey, believe only in me.
Right.
Make me your trust. So trust not in princes. Don't trust in this or that. Certainly don't trust in other gods. Trust in me, because, of course, God is the only one who is going to be faithful to us.
Do you think that these conversations that God has with Solomon are weird, too? Because Solomon usually doesn't get a chance to reply. It's like this valve gets shut off as soon as God says whatever it is that he has to say. There's no, like, and then Solomon, Solomon said, we don't know if he's like, is he mad? Is he sad? Is he scared? Like, we don't know what's going on, because God's like, I got something to say to you, says it, and then that conversation's over, apparently.
Yeah. This is going to be a monologue. It's not going to be a dialogue.
Yes.
Yeah. And probably best, because chances are, unless there's a confession of sin afterward, anything else Solomon says ain't going to be good.
Right.
So probably silence is the best response. So that takes us through verse 13. Now we're going to hear more about kind of how this all plays out. We're going to encounter Jeroboam, that servant to whom God is going to give the 10 northern tribes in a minute. But before we get there, we have to deal with two other adversaries, as it's translated here by the ESV, that God raises up. Both these guys, one is named Hadad. We hear about him in verse 14, and the other's named Rezon, or Rezin, and we hear about him in verse 23. Both these guys are referred to as an adversary. In Hebrew, that is a satan. We've talked about that word before. We get our word, capital S, Satan, from that. But very often in the Old Testament, a satan is basically a troublemaker, someone who makes trouble for you, someone who stands against you. David complains often about a satan who opposes him. And he's just basically talking about his adversaries, his foes, people who make trouble for him. Over time, that came to be the name of the deceiver, the liar, the troublemaker, Satan. But often, we have it just referred to as a human adversary. And both these guys are interesting. In fact, all three of them are interesting, because we'll see this as we go through here. There's all sorts of, how best to put this? It's almost like each of these guys in some way embodies or replicates something that happened to Israel as a nation. Like, they go into Egypt and they're befriended by Pharaoh and they marry into the family, and then later they leave Egypt. So it's kind of you have Exodus motifs happening here. And the second one, Rezin, has some kind of parallels, thematically at least, with the life of David, where he has to flee from someone who's persecuting him, and then he comes back as someone who makes trouble for the king. So it's really interesting how each of these stories is interwoven with the life of Israel. And especially, we're going to see in the first one, it's almost like there's a reversal here, where Hadad is almost a Moses figure who comes to have trouble with Solomon, who is an Egyptian figure. So I think that kind of the overall impact of this is it shows that things have become so topsy-turvy in Israel under Solomon, that he's acting like a pharaoh. He's got all these riches, all these wives, all these horses, so acting very Egyptian-like, that God brings against him an adversary who is sort of a semi-Israelite, if you will. So it's like God takes the story of Israel, and he mixes it all up here to show that everything has become mixed up in the life of Israel on account of the idolatry of Solomon. So let's go through the details. First guy, Lord raises up a Satan, an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. Now bear in mind, Edom is also the Edom is named after or is traced back to Esau. So Esau, brother of Jacob. And so Hadad is from kind of the brother family, if you will, of the Israelites. So Hadad the Edomite, he was of the royal house in Edom. So it wasn't just kind of a guy, but he was of royal stock there in Edom. And then we have a reference back to David. So when David was in Edom, and that is referred to back in 2 Samuel chapter 8, David went down there and he killed a bunch of Edomites in the Valley of Salt. He established some garrisons there and whatnot. So back in David's day, when David was in Edom and Joab was the commander of the army, they go, they strike down all the males in Edom, stay there for a long time. Well, in the midst of all of this happening, they don't kill everybody because we're told that, verse 17, that Hadad fled to Egypt. So he gets away. He's of royal stock, but they don't get him. So he runs off and he goes with some other Edomites when he was just a little, so he's a little kid. He's not even a warrior. He's a child. They go to Midian. They go to Paran, which is kind of a way station between where the Edomites lived and Egypt. And they came, we're told in verse 18, they came to Egypt, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who gave him a house. So who gave Hadad a house and assigned him an allowance of food and gave him land. And that's not it. He also was so favored in the sight of Pharaoh that he gave Hadad the wife, the sister of his wife. So his wife is named Tophonies. She's the queen. So this guy who comes from royal Edomite stock, he flees from David, ends up in Egypt. Is taken care of by Pharaoh, basically like adopted into the family, ends up marrying a princess. And then they have a child together whose name is Genuvath. And they kind of grow up there. Now, why is this important? Well, this is what I was talking about earlier. This is kind of a replication of what happened to Joseph and to Jacob and the rest of his family. So this guy ends up in Egypt, is taken in by Pharaoh's house. Same thing happens with Joseph. And then when Jacob and his family gets down there, they're given land. So you have Pharaoh and the Egyptians welcoming these people from Edom, just like Pharaoh and the Egyptians had initially welcomed Joseph and Jacob and all the family of Israel down there. Well, what happens eventually is that after this fella hears that David has died and Joab has died, that he says to Pharaoh, "Let me go." By the way, that's the same verb shalach that is used in Exodus 5:1, where Moses says to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." So let me go, let me depart, that I may go back to my own country. Pharaoh doesn't want to let him go, but he says, "Fine, eventually, let me go and let me go back." So he does, and he becomes an adversary to Solomon on the south side of the country. So it is kind of this reversal taking place where you have Hadad from Edom, a brother country to Israel, who ends up, experiences his own kind of exodus, comes back, and now he becomes a troubler of Solomon in Israel, almost like Solomon is his own Egyptian or is a Canaanite. He's acting in a way that is anti-Israelite, and so God raises up an adversary to afflict him because of that.
Yeah, it's I think it's interesting that he hears that David is dead and that Joab is dead, and he is suddenly feeling very emboldened to go back into Israel.
Especially when Joab dies.
Yeah. He's like,
yeah, David's one thing, especially in his older days, but Joab is something completely different. You don't want to mess with Joab.
Yeah. So those are the guys that obviously he was not interested in tangling with, but he's like, "Oh, those guys are dead? I will." Solomon seems kind of soft to me. I'm going to go, because, you know, Solomon's fame is spread all over the world, no doubt, on hearing that David and Joab are dead, he's probably also hearing things about Solomon. He's like, they're like, oh man, he's got the finest couches and he speaks such wise words. And this guy's like, that's not the kind of guy I'm afraid of. That sounds David and Joab, a little bit afraid of that. This guy sounds weak. He sounds like he's had it too easy for too long. I think I'm gonna go cause some trouble.
Yeah, Solomon never comes across as the warrior. He's not another David in that way. He's certainly not a Joab.
Zero experience in it.
But yeah, there's no mention whatsoever of any kind of military experience. By the way, kind of interesting name on his son. When he has a son with this Egyptian princess, they name him Genuvath. Now that comes from the Hebrew verb ganav, which means to steal. So it's kind of this idea of, you, David, stole the lives of my countrymen when you attacked us in Edom, and so I'm going to name my son that as a reminder of what you've taken away from us. So even the name of the son is suggestive of his desire to get revenge, which he gets revenge by then being an adversary to Solomon on the south. So this is one problem that Solomon begins to have, but as we'll hear in the next example, he also has a problem with the north. So this guy is from Edom. He comes from Egypt, so he's troubling the southern part of the territory of Solomon. Now we're introduced to a guy named Rezin, who's going to be a problem in the north. Verse 23, God also raised up another Satan, another adversary, named Rezin, the son of Eliada, who had fled from his master Hadadezer, king of Zobah. This also takes us back, by the way, to the time of David. In 1 Samuel 14, we're told that David conducted some wars against this guy. So he had been a servant of that king of Zobah. He gathers about him a kind of a marauding band. The Hebrew there can mean either just a band of soldiers or kind of ruffians, people who are out causing trouble, no doubt stealing, pillaging, things like that. So this guy gets around him, these ne'er-do-wells, this marauding band, after David had done all of his killing. What do? They go to Damascus, which of course is north of Israel, to Damascus and live there, and they made him king in Damascus. And he was an adversary, a satan of Israel, all the days of Solomon, doing harm as Hadad did. And he loathed Israel and reigned over Syria or Aram, however you want to translate that. So you've got one guy in the south causing problems. Now you got a guy in the north also causing problems. And they're together going to make problems for the rest of Solomon's reign. And as we'll hear much more as we go through the rest of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, it's the northern country of Aram or Syria that really becomes a problem for the Israelites as time goes on. So this is not just kind of a one-off thing. This is going to be an ongoing irritation, sometimes a violent irritation for the Israelites. And it begins here.
Yeah, it's sort of this is the end of all that peace that we were talking about. There, even if it's not an overt conflict that you're dealing with, you know, like you're out fighting a war, right, against someone. This sounds like you got like this dude on the north. It's just like a real nuisance. Like he just pops up and you know raids some village or you know that kind of thing. And so it definitely is a disturbance in the tranquility that Solomon has become accustomed to at this point.
Yeah, yeah. His the peaceful days that we're exposed to in those first few chapters about Solomon's reign are over. And it's just one more sign of everything beginning to fall apart. And as we'll see in the section that's coming up now, it's for sure going to fall apart. In fact, this is a case where you have a kind of acceleration. So you got three adversaries and there's an intensification between each of these. So you go from one to the second, and the third is going to be worse than the other two. It's a pretty common theme that you see in literature. So the third of these is going to be the biggest problem. In fact, the third of these is going to be introduced to us now. We'll hear much more about him in the rest of 1 Kings and 2 Kings. But he becomes, at least in 1 and 2 Kings, he becomes the arch-idolater, Jeroboam. He's the one who becomes associated with the the Golden Calves and Dan in Bethel. We'll hear more about that in the next episode, but let's introduce him now. And the way he's introduced is kind of fascinating, because he's introduced not as a bad character. He's introduced actually as a good guy, a dependable guy, a good overseer, a good worker, and one to whom God makes some great promises. I mean, Jeroboam could have been another David. Let's put it that way. So he's not introduced as someone who's disreputable. He's not introduced as a bad guy whatsoever. He's introduced as someone who is capable, a good leader, a good worker, and one to whom God, through his prophet, makes some promises, some great promises. So that's how we meet him. He's not a foreigner. He's an Israelite. He's from the tribe of Ephraim. His name is Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephraimite of Zeredah. He's a servant of Solomon. His mom's a widow, so at some point his dad, Nebat, dies. And it says he lifted up his hand against the king. Now, we'll see how he lifted up his hand against the king in a minute, but let's kind of learn who he is first. So Solomon had built the Millo. We've talked about that before. It's kind of an embankment there in the southeast side of Jerusalem. Solomon had built the Millo, closed up the breach of the city of David, his father, and he found that the man Jeroboam was very able. And when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he gave him charge over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. Why of the house of Joseph? Because this guy was from the tribe of Ephraim, and the tribe of Ephraim is from Joseph. So he puts him in charge, basically. He's a good worker. He's industrious, seems to know what he's doing. And so Solomon recognizes that and says, you know what? That's a guy I want to be a leader. So Solomon knows Jeroboam. Jeroboam knows Solomon. He's given a position of authority and leadership in Solomon's kingdom. Well, verse 29 tells us that at that time, Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, and this prophet that we never heard about before, named Ahijah, we're just introduced to him. And he's going to be one of many prophets who appear on the scene as we work our way through 1 and 2 Kings, who predict the future, who announce judgments upon various kings. So Ahijah, who is from Shiloh, found Jeroboam on the road. The minute that we hear that Ahijah is a Shilonite, that is from the city of Shiloh, our ears ought to perk up, because if you remember back at the beginning of 1 Samuel, Shiloh was the city where Eli and his two sons served as priests. That's where the tabernacle was set up. It was at Shiloh that you had young Samuel coming to live. And Shiloh was later destroyed by the Philistines because of the misbehavior of the sons of Eli. So Shiloh becomes, especially later in the preaching of Jeremiah, Shiloh becomes emblematic of what Shiloh's destruction becomes emblematic of what God does when his people abandon the covenant. So he's introduced here as someone from that very town, and that very town then is suggestive of what he's about to say. So Ahijah finds Jeroboam. He has dressed himself in a new garment. The two of them are alone. And Ahijah takes this new garment that's on him, and he tears it up into 12 pieces. And he says to Jeroboam, "You take 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord God of Israel, behold, I am about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon, and I'll give you 10 tribes. And Solomon's going to have one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city that I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel." Pause there for a second. So that's the scene. Jeroboam is outside the city. The prophet approaches him, tears his garment into 12 pieces, gives 10 pieces to Jeroboam, and says, "Hey, I'm about to give you those tribes of Israel." And then, you know, you don't have to be good at math to realize there's a problem here. Yeah, exactly. He says, "I'm going to save 10, one tribe."
10 plus 1 is 11. So.
Yeah, what about... Well, the best way, I think, that's been explained is, so the tribe that's not mentioned, the 12th tribe, is the tribe of Benjamin. So Benjamin is has a very small area allocated to it. It borders Judah. It's kind of swallowed up by Judah. So Judah and Benjamin basically kind of become one tribe. And so, yeah, the math doesn't work out. 10 tribes in the north, one tribe in the south. What about the other tribe? Well, you can kind of think it's the tribe in the south, Judah, is basically Judah plus Benjamin. So it's included in that. But that's what we'll have to stop there because we're out of time. But that kind of sets up the stage here as to what's going to happen. We'll see that God has more to say to Jeroboam in the next few verses. But you can see, basically, here's the peaceful, vast, rich kingdom that Solomon established. Here's what happens when idolatry is embraced. You begin to have adversaries in the south, get adversaries in the north, and now we're going to have an adversary from within, one of Solomon's own men. And God is going to use these to not just create problems, but actually to create a split in the kingdom. So you might think of it this way. Solomon's heart was divided between Yahweh and all these other gods, and so God divided his kingdom as a result.
Yeah, I mean, this is what it says. I mean, the reason given, right, is that, hey, this is going to happen because they have forsaken me, worshipped other gods, and they have not walked in my ways, doing what is right in my sight and keeping my statutes and my rules as David his father did, which always jumps out at you because you're like, what? And you realize that this has, again, everything to do with fidelity and worship.
Yeah, everything to do with First Commandment stuff.
All right, man. Well, we will get back into it next week, but we'll leave it right there. Make sure you guys register for the conference in April in Northwest Arkansas. I'd love to see you there. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.